Good morning. Welcome to the House K-12 Education Finance Committee hearing for Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. Remote hearings such as this are held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This rule has been posted online and is linked to in our public meeting notice on the House website. All remote hearings will be recorded and live streamed by House Public Information Services. Members have the contents of their packets available to them virtually, and for the public, these same materials have been posted online. Members, if you're looking for all these items in one place, they are attached to the calendar event that you have that Ms. Burt sent for today. To get on the list to be recognized by the chair, members using the Zoom interface have the ability to raise their hand via the app. Ms. Burt will place your name in the queue to be recognized. Ms. Sunderland, would you please call the roll?
Chair Dabney.
Present.
Vice Chair Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Kreisha. Representative Kreisha.
Representative Kreisha is going to be a little late.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Damuth.
Present.
Representative Drazkowski.
Here.
Representative Erickson.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Jordan.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Thompson.
Present.
Representative Wolgamott. He's been excused for this morning. Representative Zhang.
Present.
And Representative Joachim.
Present.
That is the roll, and we do have a quorum.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sunderland. Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes for today's meeting?
I have had a chance to look at the minutes from the meetings from yesterday, Mr. Chair, and I move them.
Thank you very much. Any discussion to the Jordan motion? Hearing none. All those in favor of the Jordan motion approving the minutes of our Tuesday, February 9th meeting, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Members, today we'll be discussing and laying over two bills. First up is House File 843, and then we'll move on to House File 146. Representative Jordan, would you like to make a motion, since you seem to be on a tear here this morning, to move House File 843 to be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion for further consideration at a later date?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Members of the committee and members of the public were aiming to lay this bill over by 10:55 this morning. Representative Chair Stevenson, welcome to the committee. You may proceed with introducing your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's such a joy to be before this committee on such an important subject. House File 843 is a bill that will provide financial stability to all Minnesota public schools at a time when stability is badly needed. Minnesota is, of course, a state that prides itself in its schools, and we absolutely should. They're critical to our remarkable quality of life. After all, businesses don't choose to locate in Minnesota because we have oil in the ground or low taxes, and they certainly aren't here because of the weather, as we have vividly seen over the last few days. Businesses are here because of our people. We have highly skilled, highly educated workforce in Minnesota, and that doesn't just happen. It's something we have to build each year and every year. And as my parents taught me, in life, you get what you pay for. If you want to have a great education system, you have to pay for it. The problem is, in inflation-adjusted dollars, state funding for public schools is lower now than it was in 2003. That's an uncomfortable fact for me and for us as legislators that may want to talk about how we increase education funding every year. But it's true. We can't just set aside inflation. And we do it all too often when we're budgeting. And I tend to think that when you're attempting to budget, if you attempt to budget while ignoring inflation, is a bit like attempting to fly while ignoring gravity. You're welcome to try, but the outcome is going to be ugly. So in that context, let me give the committee three reasons why this bill is needed. First, it stabilizes funding. Under our current model, the biennial funding cycle forces school districts to assume that no new funding will be available after the second year of the biennium. The reality is that every school district experiences inflationary increases in expenses separate from salaries and benefits, utilities, transportation, lease spaces, contracted services, some of the areas where district might experience a 5 to even 15% increase year over year. Without any guarantees for state funding, these expenses force a district to project deficits or gamble on increased state funding. This process leads to districts carrying fund balances to offset known expenses increases in the event state funding doesn't come through. A predictable state funding model may result in districts lowering fund balance amounts and reducing short-term cuts while waiting for state funding to be determined. Second, continuity of staffing levels, especially around retaining teachers in specific shortage areas and retaining teachers of color. By statute, school districts must let teachers know if they are rehired by April 1st. This is typically 6 to 10 weeks before the state funding is determined. Districts either need to cut staff as a precaution or overspend and hope funding is provided. Many people have shared that a large number of teachers leave their field in the first few years. And one reason for this is the uncertainty of positions early in a teacher's career. Even if the teacher is rehired, it may be in a different position or school. As we try to diversify our staff, our newest employees are frequently teachers of color. Combining this uncertainty with the challenge of feeling isolated in a predominantly white field of employment, it is understandable that some of your newer teachers of color are very frustrated. Third, there will be earning loss and social emotional needs of students due to COVID. And this may look different in districts around the state, but we can all agree that we need to address these issues, and this bill will help with that. Districts frequently scrape by financially, hoping to maintain this year's class sizes, programs, and student support into the next. There are limited opportunities to invest in systemic improvements. Much needed supports like counselors, social workers, and school-based mental health staff are luxuries at a time when expenditures increase faster than revenue. For example, my district that I represent, the state's largest school district, Nokahennepin, if they wanted to add an additional support staff for every 500 students, this would cost the district $7.6 million. 2% on the formula generates $5.8 million. Anoka-Hennepin may have the desire to add in these areas, but long-term ability to fund them is non-existent without stability in funding. So, Mr. Chair, for those reasons, I would ask the committee to give strong consideration to House File 843, and I know there are some testifiers that are happy to talk about this subject.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I have three testifiers listed on the agenda. The first on my copy is Mike Redmond, Dr. Redmond, Superintendent of the Shakopee Public Schools. Dr. Redmond, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dabney. My name is Mike Redmond, and I'm currently the Superintendent of Shakopee Public Schools, and want to thank you and members of the committee for your time today. And then also mention that I'm also representing AMSD. I'm a member of their legislative committee. And MASA, I'm the current chair of their legislative committee. And ultimately, my goal today is, to talk about greater efficiency in E-12 finance, my support for HF 843 through the lens of both a former economics teacher, which I was, and a current superintendent. And so with that, to kind of get a little bit more specific, going to hopefully present a rationale for why at least 2 and 2 on the general education formula and indexing the general education formula to inflation are both very sound economic ideas. And I like what Representative Stevenson said, help us in the way of making education finance much more predictable. When it comes to 2 and 2 on the formula, an economics concept that I tend to turn to is something called real income, which is really a person's buying power from, over time, 1 year to the next. And, looking at projected rates of inflation for calendar year 21, right now, most sources say, it's projected at 1.8 to 2.2%. That falls in line with years 2015 through 2019. Another thing that I'm fond of doing is talking about, an oversimplified example. If you're an economics teacher, you have to do that. But, so for example, if what people are buying, teachers and other employees of a school district are buying in the calendar year 21 or fiscal year 21, if they go up by 2%, if their salary, their wages and benefits remain unchanged from this year to next, well, they actually have less buying power. They have less in terms of real income. And if that salary goes up by the same, you know, rate of inflation or the cost of goods and services by that 2%, they actually, in terms of real income, they're the same as they are this year. And sometimes, you know, we get that one-sided representation of market reality. When times are tough, you know, I often hear, you know, some person say that, yep, everybody needs to tighten their belts. And I get that in a sense. But they want to apply, you know, a private sector market reality to E12 education in that situation. However, in those times when, you know, that economic reality is very good in the private sector and you might see 10% or 20% salary increases or some large, you know, annual bonuses, I don't hear the same people, you know, who are talking about the belt tightening in the tough times. You know, I don't hear them talking about, hey, now is the time for that really large increase, you know, that private sector-like increase in the good times. And I think what I'm really getting at is the goal ultimately needs to be consistency in E12 funding in both the tough economic times and the good economic times, because when you start to lag behind inflation, as Representative Stevenson alluded to, it's hard to make that up. And so consistency is you know, very, very important. And also important for a number of reasons, I think, is the idea of indexing the general education formula to inflation. And I want to share a couple of just realities of school district budgeting and staffing. Our fiscal year runs July 1 through June 30th. Right now, we're in the thick of budgeting and staffing in my district, and I believe in most districts across Minnesota. Laying out, you know, what our budget projection will be, which is, you know, less predictable than we would like, laying out our staffing allocations and working through a process. We're a service organization. I think sometimes people, you know, think of schools as buildings and structures and you know, kind of goods rather than services. And we are predominantly a service industry. In our organizations, when we talk about operational budgets, 80% or more than 80% is spent on people. It's spent on wages and benefits. 60%, typically right in that range, is spent on the wages and benefits of teachers who are providing, you know, the most important service, that classroom instruction and other forms of instruction to our students.
Superintendent, if you could focus in on wrapping up at this point.
I will. Yep.
Make room for the other panelists. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you, Chair. And I just want to get back to budget assumptions, and I think that's the key point. Right now, we're forced to make budget assumptions based on what we're trying to predict the legislature may do when it comes to E12 funding. Our timelines don't add up very well. They don't mesh well. So it's really a lose-lose proposition. If we're too aggressive in the assumption, we end up overstaffed. Fund balances take unplanned hits, or you double cut in the following year. If we're too conservative, we end up releasing quality teachers, and things just don't align well. So, again, I would just love to express my support for House File 843, and I'd be happy to answer any questions at any time, and certainly appreciate your time and service to our state, both the chair and the members of this committee. So thank you for allowing me time today.
Thank you, Superintendent. We'll be, we've got two other panelists, and then we'll take questions from members at that time. So please stick around. Next is Ron Meyer, Executive Director of Finance and Operations for the Osseo Area Schools. Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ron Meyer. I am the Executive Director of Finance and Operations for Osseo Area Schools. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm here to express our support for the proposed House File 843 and describes its potential impact on students and stakeholders in Osseo Area Schools. While there are many reasons why an increase to the formula allowance based on the Consumer Price Index is beneficial for school districts, I will focus my comments this morning around the impact related to recruiting, hiring, and retaining a diverse workforce. First, I want to describe a little bit about who we are. Osseo Area Schools is the fifth largest school district in Minnesota. We serve over 20,000 students, and we're located in the Northwest metropolitan suburbs. We are a wonderfully diverse school district where 58% of our students are students of color, which represents the fourth highest number of students of color in the state of Minnesota. Our students, where more than 111 languages are spoken. This richness and diversity has given us a sense of urgency in recruiting, hiring, and retaining a teacher and staff workforce that reflects the same diversity of the students and families that we serve. Through a myriad of intentional strategies, our district has started to see some encouraging results. Since 2014, our licensed teachers of color percentage has increased from 5.2% to 8.3%. Our non-licensed staff has increased from 8.9% to 18.2%. And our administrative leadership team has increased from 15.9% to 28.3% staff of color. While we have experienced some success in recruiting and hiring teachers and staff of color, the real success indicator of our efforts will be based on our ability to retain those team members into the future. Stable and predictable funding is necessary to retaining a diverse workforce. To ensure financial sustainability into the future, we need to make decisions today based on realistic financial projections. And we do this by making budget assumptions that will impact our funding, including things like enrollment changes, as well as changes in state funding. In our current model, the assumptions that we make around state funding is typically very conservative and is based on a two-year biennial cycle not currently tied to the rate of inflation. The result of these conservative assumptions often is a projection for deficit spending in future years. As an example, because we do not know what the per pupil formula may be set at for next year and beyond, our conservative revenue assumptions have our district projected to be forced to make budget cuts of $5 million in FY23, $7 million in FY24, and $8 million in FY25. With over 80% of our budget allocated to teachers and staff, we will likely be forced to make reductions in staff to close this budget gap. Because many of our teachers and staff of color are lower in seniority, we risk losing the successes we have made in increasing our employees of color. Passage of House File 843 would ensure that school districts receive at least inflationary increases each year. This will give districts like Osseo Area Schools more stability in our financial projections and will limit cuts that will undoubtedly impact our recruiting and retaining efforts. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time and attention to this morning and for your consideration of this important piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Next on my list is Sarah Weiss, school board member. Ms. Weiss, if you'd please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Weiss, and I have the privilege to serve on the ISD 728 school board, which includes the communities of Elk River, Otsego, Rogers, and Zimmerman. I'm here today on behalf of not only ISD 728, but for all Minnesota children and school districts. More specifically, I'm here to express ISD 728 support for House File 843 and appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts. House Finance Bill HF 843 increases the general education basic formula allowance by 2% per year for fiscal years 22 and 23 and links future increases in the formula to the increase in the CPI for that year. ISD 728, like other districts, continues to face budget reductions due to yearly inflationary costs. For example, inflationary increases total $3 to $4 million every year, staffing, utilities, special education costs, et cetera. Formula increases required 7 years of budget cuts totaling $20.2 million for ISD 728 because they did not cover expenses. The cross subsidy alone in ISD 728 is approximately $11 million. In other words, we spent $11 million out of the general budget to cover costs for special education, which are mandated but not funded. ISD 728, like other districts, has incurred costs due to COVID-19 pandemic that were unexpected and not funded. While the dollars have helped cover costs related to PPE, technology for families at risk, mental health, et cetera, the funds do not come close to covering expenses related to staffing, childcare, et cetera. To adjust for inflationary costs and recoup unexpected expenditures, ISD 728 and other districts will need to continue to make reductions in areas to make up the shortfall. Historically, the legislature does not finalize funding until the end of the session. ISD 728, like other districts, begin to plan for the next fiscal year starting in January. Projections are based on a best guess funding formula with no guarantee of the actual percentage. As a result, districts are often required to hire people last minute or to let people go because their assumptions did not match what was actually funded. Funding through a stable formula allows ISD 728 and other districts to project future revenues with confidence and adjust future expenditures accordingly. Continuity for staffing levels, especially around retaining teachers in specific shortage areas and retaining teachers of color, would make all school districts better. Staffing for the upcoming school year starts in February. Staffing projections are based on a best guess funding formula. Funding dictates the number of staff and potential staff reductions. As mentioned previously, approximately 80% of every school district's budget are people. When stable funding is not provided, people lose their jobs unnecessarily, and oftentimes school districts are unable to retain highly qualified staff. Continuing contract law requires districts to notify staff prior to July 1st that their contract is non-renewed for probationary staff or they're put on unrequested leave for continuing contract staff. This process must proceed without knowing actual funding. Many of these staff seek positions in other districts. Many of the hard-to-fill positions, such as math, science, facts, special education, have the highest probationary staff, creating retention and recruiting problems. Responding to the learning loss and social and emotional needs of students due to COVID, 2% funding and stabilization allows ISD 728 to direct sources to the SEL and other programs for students who have struggled during the pandemic. Without stability of funding, school districts cannot implement thoughtful and comprehensive programming to meet all of the unique needs students and families have. Especially during times.
If you could finish your comments, please.
Furthermore, there must be a reasonable understanding that programs can continue one year to next. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share this information and for considering HS 843 on behalf of ISD 728 and all our school districts. I would like to thank you for your work and effort to support our children and families. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have several members with questions. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Stevenson and Testa Myers, thank you. You all made a compelling argument to repeal LIFO, last in, first out. So thank you for making that point, especially you, Representative Stevenson. I hope you'll consider that in the future. But my question, Representative Stevenson, for you is, you know, we can do increases to K-12 education on an annual basis or regularly for the biennium. Inflation is unpredictable. So, you know, if we were to, you know, just set a priority for increasing spending for education, because it's our obligation early in the session, we could do that, but we would have to reduce spending in other areas. So where would you propose that we reduce spending in other areas so we could do this due diligence to K-12 education?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Erickson. I disagree very strongly with the premise of your question that it would require offsets in other areas or cutting spending in other areas. I don't know that that scarcity mindset is necessarily appropriate. And I also think that we have to recognize that our prosperity and quality of life in Minnesota is driven by educational investments. They are important, and we should prioritize them. I think inflation actually has been remarkably predictable over the last few years. We've been in an era of very stable and very low inflation. That's very fortunate, and but we should plan around it. What the legislature is doing now is, and what the state has been doing for the last several years, has just been ignoring a simple law of economics. Things cost more as time goes on, and we shouldn't do that.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Stevenson, we have other areas that we fund, you know, other budgetary agencies, et cetera, that have a lot of programs connected. And I think we could take a serious look at how we could reduce spending there so we could do the due diligence to what's being requested of us for our K-12 students. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill up. I think you are creating a space for us to have a really important conversation about how funding relates to district planning. My question is for Mr. Meyer from the Osseo School District, I believe. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about how the current budget, the current way we allocate funding impacts your planning for schools. We've heard a lot about how in this committee about the need for greater investments and mental health resources for students. We've talked a lot about how to make sure that we're retaining our teachers of color. Can you talk a little bit about how a lack of stability in this funding is impacting your planning and where you are investing in new programs for the Osseo School District?
Mr. Meyer.
Yes, thank you, Chair and Representative Jordan, for the question. As I commented in my testimony, we are working through our budget assumptions and putting together our budget assumptions right now. In fact, at our school board meeting, our school board work session last evening, we brought forth some of our budget assumptions based on our current reality and what we know right now, which is our current reality and our enrollment. And we have lost significant enrollment due to the pandemic, as well as what we don't know, which is the state funding in the next biennium, which is the main source of revenue for our school district. And so as we are putting together those conservative assumptions, we have to make difficult decisions on where we're going to allocate those limited resources in the midst of those conservative assumptions. And so, as I indicated, some of the really great work that our district has done in recruiting and retaining that diverse workforce and increasing our teachers and staff of color over the last several years, we have a lot of new employees and staff of color. And because of that, they are lower in the seniority. And so when we have to make difficult choices, budget decisions as it relates to staffing, because that's the biggest part of our budget, those teachers and staff of color are impacted by those choices that have to be made. And so our district has done a really good job in working with our bargaining groups to be creative. And how do we make sure that as a school district, we place a high value on a diverse workforce. And so we have put together some creative ways of doing it, but certainly the biggest lever in that is our budget and the assumptions that we have to make. And so without that stable, predictable funding and tied to inflation, it makes it very difficult for us to project into the future and to make those difficult decisions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, Mr. Meyer, I don't mean to pick on you. Can you talk to me a little bit about what some of those creative tactics might be and how you've worked with your bargaining units to achieve that?
Mr. Meyer.
Yes, thank you for the question, Representative Jordan. One of the ways as we go through a process of having to reduce our workforce, whether it's because we're reducing in enrollment or because of difficult budget cuts, we have agreements in place with our bargaining groups specifically to be able to reserve a certain number of positions for those employees to essentially protect those employees that are great performers and that really define the mission and the vision for our organization. And so that's one of the ways through our contracts that we've been able to be able to be creative. Again, having to make those reductions are always difficult, but working really closely with our bargaining groups to, through our contractual languages, as well as some of our memorandums of understanding, to work together to try to protect some of those positions.
Members, if I may intercede at this point, my understanding is that Chair Stevenson has to move on to a different meeting at this time. We're not dismissing any of the panelists, so Mr. Meyer, you're not off the hook necessarily yet, but I did want to recognize that the author does need to leave. Representative Stevenson, do you want to make any last comment before your departure?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, and I appreciate you your flexibility with regard to my my calendar. This is an important bill. There's nothing more important to Minnesotans than having a high quality, world-class school system, and that, as I mentioned, costs money. This is a common-sense bill that's going to allow for predictable and stable funding for our schools. It's supported by MSBA, MASA, AMSD, and MREA, and I hope the committee will strongly consider including it in the budget bill this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Representative Jordan, were you done with your line of questioning, or do you have additional questions?
I was, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you to Mr. Meyer as well.
Thank you. Representative Kreshaw.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, so to the panelists, and I guess I understand that the author had to leave. I wish that hadn't happened. to keep the conversation, but I understand. To the panelists, there isn't many members on this committee that wouldn't like to see a budget that helps our local school districts and helps you with the jobs you have in front of you. The question is, how do we get there? So, I mean, we hear this every session, every biennium, that this is a viable idea, that something's being proposed. The question that I have for you is, just like you, we have to adhere to budgets that are finite. How do we get there? Are there mandates we can reduce? Are there other areas that we can help you with to get to this stability, knowing there isn't an infinite amount? And so whoever would like to answer that.
Who would like to take that from the panel? Superintendent, I was going to say, I think you said you were an economics teacher, so we'll go there. Superintendent?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Kreshup. The reality is, you know, we've exhausted nearly all of those things. When we look at, you know, we're so used to working from a level of scarcity and trying to build efficiency into the process. Part of the reality of, indexing the general formula to inflation is part of how we do things, you know, working in partnership with the legislature. You know, every couple of years, we spend an inordinate amount of time discussing what percentage, should go on to the formula. And there appears to be a fairly strong agreement when we look over time that, you know, most people will recognize that real income, you know, if we're not increasing the general education formula by at least the amount of inflation, we're actually, in terms of real spending power, decreasing our funding of E-12 education. And so taking that off the table then allows us to use some of that time that we tend to spend every couple of years talking about what percentage on the formula and really dig into. We've had a finance task force that has done a lot of work. There are areas that we can gain efficiency. We can also prioritize. And ultimately, any budget comes down to what you're prioritizing. I'm incredibly comfortable working, you know, we need to balance our budgets like you. To me, you know, E-12 education is an incredible top priority. It's about the future of our state. It's about the future of our economic prosperity. It touches every aspect of every citizen's life in one way or another. And I think just eliminating that discussion, which is a pretty low-level discussion about the formula, would allow us to dig in and try to find ways where we can, you know, hopefully find some efficiency. But to be quite frankly, in my district, we're in the process right now of cutting $7 million. So we've been operating out of scarcity. It's not what would we like to do. It's what we have to do with the scarce resources we have.
Representative Krishna?
No follow-up. That's fine.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, Superintendent Redmond kind of answered my question already. I was going to ask about the stability that adding inflation onto the formula would give schools and planning. I know that you all, especially I want to thank school board member Sarah Weiss, too. I know you all take your jobs very seriously about being efficient with taxpayer money. But inflation, from what I understand, and maybe you could touch on it again, would give you that sense of stability for planning. That's a separate discussion than putting money on the formula, because we haven't even caught the formula up for inflation to about 2000, since about 2003. One thing I was going to ask the author before he was able to leave, and I'll take it this to him offline, is wondering if it would be better to look at the implicit price to play deflator instead of the consumer price index to index it too, since the IPD is a little bit more stable and more clearly reflects the public service sector, where 80% of your 80% of your costs are people and not products, which, you know, the consumer price index deals with a basket of goods, not a basket of people. So Superintendent Redmond, I don't know if you had anything else to add to that.
Or either of the other panelists. Superintendent?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Joachim. You did a very good job of summing that up, but indexing the general formula to inflation then aligns that, you know, in terms of real income and does help us with predictability. Currently, right now, you know, the real life example in my district is we are coming up with budget assumptions for the next 2 years, the biennium, if you will. The only kind of actual data information we have, you know, is the New North plan released by Governor Walz, which indicated, you know, what their goals or thoughts are. Everybody else, you know, the February budget forecast is an important piece. So knowing that it were, you know, if we could trust that it were going to go up by the rate of inflation, and I think a further discussion about which deflator or which measure of that, it's an important one, that would help us to focus that particular piece of our budget assumption much better than currently. It's not the be-all, end-all. There's still going to be assumptions on enrollment, but we spend a lot of time predicting those, finding nuances year over year. Obviously, in a pandemic, you know, that goes out the window, but most years we're pretty good at predicting enrollment. Knowing that the general formula would be indexed to inflation helps to do a better job with those assumptions, and then we wouldn't miss the mark by as far as we currently do in either direction. And they're both bad directions. We lose either way if we're too aggressive or too conservative in our assumptions. And that's maybe the economics part of me. Either of those is really inefficient. So thank you for the question.
Thank you. Representative Youakim, anything else?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not for now.
Thank you very much. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to the presenters. I guess I'd have a question for any of the presenters, Mr. Chair, and that is the private sector has hemorrhaged jobs and thousands of businesses have been lost. These are the people that that you are asking us to force to cough up more money, according to the author of the bill, to take more money from them in order to fund you going forward so that you don't have to make difficult decisions. Those decisions in the private sector have already been made against the will of everybody. My question is, Mr. Chair, I don't know of a single government employee that has lost their job because of the pandemic since it began. We have bus drivers that are working in their basements. So the question I would have for the presenters is, how many employees have they lost due to the pandemic, and what does that represent as a proportion of their employee base, and what is their percentage of pupil loss since the pandemic began? Those are my questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Would any of the panelists care to respond to Representative Drazkowski?
Chair Daphne, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Meyer. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Daphne, Representative Drazkowski. I will say for Osseo Area Schools, while we have continued to offer education as well as food service and transportation of technology equipment, we have kept our staff certainly busy, and they have taken on an extra burden through especially the pandemic. I will also say in our community ed department specifically, we have laid off a number of employees because we're not able to offer much of the programming that we were pre-pandemic. And at the same time, we are required to offer tier one childcare for free for those tier one employees in our school district. And so we have had a significant impact on the community ed fund in our school district, and at the same time laid off a number of employees through that process. So we have worked very closely with all of our leaders in our school district and our board to make sure that we are making sure that we're offering the services and the educational services to our students and families that we need to during this difficult time, and at the same time being very conscious and sensitive to the very real budget realities that we are facing as well.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Representative Drazkowski.
So Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, I still have not heard, Mr. Chair, a number come forward. I heard a number of employees in community education, which is not tied to that teaching part, that the pupils are lost from these schools. I'm trying to remember the numbers. I think some of the testimony we had earlier committee meetings, Mr. Chair, were in the double digits of percentage of pupils lost by these school districts. And the reality is, and it's a great thing for employees in schools and government throughout. It's great for them that they're in a position to do that. But members, Mr. Chair, and presenters, I hope some sense of reality can come to you when you see what's going on in the private sector. Thousands of businesses have been lost. I don't know how many thousands of jobs have been lost, or tens or hundreds of thousands of jobs in this state. But these are the people that you are asking us to force to give up more of the money that they have left in order to fund you an increase. And you haven't been under the same type of scenario that they have been. You haven't been exposed to the same real-life market conditions because you're government. And I understand that, and I think we all understand that. But we need you to understand their position that they're in, and we need government to have some empathy for the private sector that you, again, are asking us to force to pay more for your next biennium. So that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, presenters.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Members, the author of our next bill is in the room, Representative Wolgamott. I do want to start us moving to transition to that. I see Representative Feist has her hand up, and I know that in the members' packets and posted online, of course, were individual district runs related to this bill, and I will ask also after Representative Feist that Mr. Strom walk members through those runs. But at this time, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to respond to Representative Drazkowski as well. I just don't think there is any comparison between funding our education, our E-12, and the private sector. I just feel like these are apples and oranges. And I thought that Mr. Redmond had a very good point that we tried to compare education funding to the private sector, but then when the market is great and jobs are booming and everything is great, we're not like, this is the time to like just pour cash into our schools. These are just not comparable in my mind. And like Representative Stevenson so eloquently said, you know, this is about the future of our state. This is about everything. And I just think that we need to not be in that scarcity mindset. And I don't believe that we would be funding this bill on the backs of, you know, laid off workers. I think that we can find other sources of income from people in Minnesota who want to invest in our schools and our great way of life. So I just wanted to emphasize that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Feist. Mr. Strom, can you walk us through your work?
Mr. Chair, members, I'll try to be as brief as possible. Ms. Burt will pull up a copy of the printout that's in your packets. We're happy to share this in a spreadsheet form if that's more helpful for committee members. When we put out printouts like this that show increases, part of the challenge is to make sure that members have good things to compare to. So this printout, organized like most of them, shows the districts and district number order. For members who are looking through their printouts, the three school districts in front of us today are districts number 279 Osseo, 720 for Shakopee, and 728 for Elk River. So members could look at those lines if they're interested in the impact on those committees. We tend, when we show printouts, to show them on a per pupil basis. This information is all based on the November forecast, and it'll be changed in a couple of weeks here when we move to the February forecast. But one thing that we find is that if we show amounts on a per pupil basis, those changes in pupil counts are likely to happen. And so a total oftentimes is misleading. Sometimes it helps to balance, but generally, if we can look at an amount per pupil, when the number of pupils, when the districts get better estimates, that helps us with that. So the first two columns just show that in fiscal year 21, there's 946,000 pupils, and the average general ed revenue per district is 9,296. Then there's two sets of columns for each of the next 2 years. The first of those for fiscal year 22, you can see the pupil count is still expected to increase over the previous year to 956,000 students. The baseline funding, should the legislature not act, would be $9,272, which would be just a little less than fiscal year 21. And with Representative Stevenson's bill, if a 2% increase were enacted, the revenue would go up on average to $9,408 per pupil. So those numbers, districts often don't compare to the base, which is what we're doing here. They'll often look year to year. So if a member wanted or if a district wanted, they could look at FY22 compared to FY21 and see the result there. The next set of columns do the same thing for the second year of the biennium. And you can see there the 962,000 pupils. The base level of funding, presuming the legislature did not make any changes this year, $9,410 per pupil. With the 2% increase in the first year and an additional 2% increase in the second year, that increases on average to $9,684 per pupil. And then the last four columns show those increases on a per pupil basis and in total. So in the first year there, you can see $129 million increase, which is $135 per pupil. Again, that's an increase over base. Members or districts could certainly choose to compare that to 21 instead, but that's the increase for base. And then the second year is shown there as well. And you can see there that the increase over base is $263 million compared to the base budget. Or $274. Again, a district may prefer to compare to, or a member may prefer to compare that number to the previous year instead of to the base. But in total, then, what a proposal like Representative Stevenson's would mean for this committee is that in the first year of the biennium, the spending would be up $129 million, and in the second year, $263 million. So it's the sum of those two that this committee would be spending if an increase of 2% per year were enacted. Mr. Chair, I'm happy for members to contact me separately. I know you're short of time today if members would like to have a more detailed discussion of the printouts or what it means for their districts.
Mr. Strom, thank you. That is a spreadsheet that might take a little chewing on for any number of us. But thank you for producing it and walking us through it. Any last comments or questions before we transition to Representative Wolgamott's bill? Seeing none, I want to thank the three panelists for joining us today. Representative Jordan renews her motion that House File 843 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. Thank you all very much. Representative Wolgamott.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Good morning to you and good morning to my fellow committee members and to the public who is tuning in. I'm here before you this morning to present House File 156, which is a bill to create a Tier 3 Education Partnership Program grant, as well as to provide increased funding to existing education partnership programs. Education Partnerships Coalition members are Austin Aspires, Cradle of Career in Rochester, Every Hand Joined in Red Wing, Generation Next in the Twin Cities, Northfield Promise, Northside Achievement Zone in Minneapolis, St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, and United Way of Central Minnesota, best for last in my opinion because that's who serves my community in St. Cloud. The coalition engages more than 120,000 youth and their families all across Minnesota. This really is, you know, metro, suburbs, greater Minnesota partnership. The coalition members take a birth-to-career approach to eliminating Minnesota's worst-in-the-nation opportunity gaps. All coalition members are locally controlled, data-driven, public-private partnerships. This collective impact focus brings communities together to enact solutions that improve outcomes for children and families. Chair members, like I said, this is a unique coalition with both urban, metro, suburban members, and it's been recognized as a national leader in collective impact. This year, EPC members have served their communities through the COVID-19 pandemic and in the face of continued racial injustice. Members have led in ensuring hundreds of students have devices and Wi-Fi access for distance learning. They've distributed thousands of boxes of food and provided hundreds of thousands of dollars in emergency rental relief. But despite the coalition's best efforts, families are continuing to struggle throughout Minnesota. Without swift and bold action, our families are in jeopardy of falling further behind. Mr. Chair, members, now is the time to invest in our students, invest in our parents, and invest in our communities so that two generations of Minnesotans can thrive. That's why I'm asking for your support for House File 156. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to turn over to my testifiers.
With that, Representative Wolgamont moves that House File 156 be before the committee and laid over for possible inclusion or further consideration at a later date. Representative Wolgamont, I have three panelists listed on the agenda who've previously contacted us. We'll start with Sandra Samuels from the Northside Achievement Zone. Ms. Samuels, good to see you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chair Dabney, members of the committee. My name is Sandra Samuels, and I am president and CEO of the Northside Achievement Zone. Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Thank you so much, Representative Wolgamott, for being the chief author of this important legislation, along with all of the bipartisan co-authors. I really appreciate you. I've been before this committee before, and, you know, again, the Northside Achievement Zone exists to permanently close the opportunity gap and end generational poverty as we know it in North Minneapolis. The whole premise of ours is the power of place. We are partnered with our partners across the state of Minnesota, but also across the country. And these are all places where we know that schools can't do it alone. And when schools and community unite, we are pretty unstoppable. And we are working on both the racial achievement gap, but also ending systemic poverty. And getting our kids in and through college. And I tell you, I want to talk really quickly about some of our outcomes over the last year. We really went into emergency response mode. We had everybody's experiencing the same things, you know, C-19, its impact on families and schools and communities, and then the murder of George Floyd and all of the racial unrest and civic unrest and the riots and looting and closing of businesses. And right now in our community, I want to focus on the children, but we're a two-generation approach. They are dealing with wanton violence. And so the trauma on top of not having the security of parents having work, knowing where their next meal is going to come from, whether they can pay their rent. You know, 74% of our families make $30,000 or less. And not having the security of school, even though our children are about to return to the classroom, the younger, the primary age scholars, it has been... it has been a tumultuous year. And so we pivoted as much as we could. And you can see from the report some of the things that we focused on over the last year and we're still focusing on, really trying to step in and fill the gap of where the schools used to be able to provide so much support. Namely, a couple of things. We've given out over $300,000 in cash assistance, something we've never done before. We'll be giving out at least $200,000 more gift cards to families, $100, $200. They are really suffering right now. We've given out over $300,000 in rental assistance. And I tell you, it's been incredibly needed. We will do that again. And here's the power of the partnerships that we have arrayed around our schools. We spent the last decade building trust. And so when this emergency hit, we moved to meeting weekly with our school partners, our workforce, housing, early childhood, health, out of school time, and troubleshooting what do our families need now. And then we had a seamless pipeline around how to get the support to them. We also turned into, and again, because the schools, you know, weren't in session, we also turned into food providers. And you can see from the report that we, in partnership with Second Harvest and some local organizations, gave out 43,000 meals. We continue to do to give out meals, 36,000 pounds of food. And that was 100 families got those delivered to their homes. In terms of technology, getting at the racial divide, we have given out 726 Chromebooks and iPads, 719 headphones. We invested in 1,000 access for 1,000 families to get broadband support from Comcast. And then around safety in terms of the community, we've given out 140,000 masks. And we have also, we're engaged right now. And any of you who are in Minneapolis, you'll start seeing a huge public relations campaign around masking up and not having the, and addressing the fact that our community is disproportionately vaccine hesitant. And that's with the PR campaign. So we're wrapping buses and doing billboards, continuing to give out masks, getting testimonies from people in the community who look like the families that we serve, who have been vaccinated and are still living and healthy. We are trying to narrow the tutoring gap, and we are working with our partners, Reading Partners and Reading Corps, still in terms of tutors for our scholars, still investing in after school. Right now, we're thinking really hard around summer programming and how to get as many students in vital summer programming that both addresses the academic loss, but also the trauma that they have gone through during this whole time. And the thing I'll end with is, we have the mental health supports are serious. And boy, I tell you, I feel like the schools will need the education partnership more now than they did before we faced what we faced in 2020. One of our key health mental health partners is Washburn Children's Center. And they have gone to telehealth like we have, like our workforce partners have. Virtual. So they've gone to telehealth. We do our parenting education classes online now, for example. But Washburn can see more of our families and they can see more of our children because of that. And so we're working hard to make those connections. And I want to close by just thanking you for your support. You all may have met, I think, one of our moms who used to come to the Capitol a lot, Salima Salid Din. And she had children school age and early childhood. And Salima died 2 days before George Floyd of an acute asthma attack. And that had everything, that was totally preventable, had everything to do with her heightened levels of depression as well. Many of our parents, it's not just the students, by the way, it's the parents, it's the teachers. We have a community wellness team that works alongside Washburn. But the thing that our community wellness team works on most directly is working with teachers. And our teachers have been tapping into our supports. We wouldn't be able to do this without support from you all. And we hope and we're proud to be here with our partners in St. Paul and Greater Minnesota. This is about all of our children across the state. We thank you. We hope that you will support House File 156 because together we can come out better. Thank you, Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Ms. Samuels. Next on my list is Tiffany Daniels, a parent from, I think I've heard of this organization, United Way of Central Minnesota. Ms. Daniels, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Dabney and members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Tiffany Daniels, and I'm a St. Cloud parent. The challenges my family and I faced due to distance learning were numerous. From the very start, my children were ages 11, 9, and 3 were affected negatively. Being away from friends and family or friends out of school environment caused stress on my oldest son, who made lots of friends and was very active in sports and clubs in high school or in his school. He struggles with ADHD, and after a few weeks, he became very weary, which made staying at home very challenging for us all. The curriculum and paperwork given to us from their school seemed very difficult without the face-to-face instruction from their teachers. And we were really prepared for the shift, and that made a lot of stress on our family. Financially, our income decreased because I had to stay with the children throughout the day, and my husband's income decreased because of the pandemic and the stay-at-home orders for businesses and churches. My husband is a pastor, and he runs a small construction business as well, both of which brought little to no income during the months of April and November. We depleted our savings and needed to request help from bank loans and the state to help us through just to get through. This also caused a lot of stress on our family. Many of the families in our community struggle with layoffs, low unemployment checks, and just the stress of having children who were home for distance learning. Through the partnerships with United Way in Central Minnesota, we were able to rent space through Atonement Lutheran Church to create socially distanced learning pods for our children. And this allowed parents to go to jobs or job search and leave their kids in a safe environment while being supported with their distance learning. Once the word got out, our numbers continued to grow. Although we had to turn some families away due to being short on volunteer staff and space, we were still happy to help all the families that we were able to help. The United Way of Central Minnesota was able to secure funding to support some rent and modest support to our to those who worked with us and working with our youth. They connected us with training to better support the students and the distance to the district to assess hot spots and other supports and to provide access to food for the kids during the day. So this approach of collective impact is making a huge difference in our community and with our families. We're still desperately trying to recover from all of the challenges from the pandemic and the difficulties we're faced and we're yet to face, are yet to be seen, but we pray for the resilience and the protection of our kids daily, and we're grateful for the opportunity to partner with United Way of Central Minnesota, Partner for Student Success, and I support House File 156 because it will help more families like mine and the families I'm helping to serve. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Daniels. Last of the three speakers, I'm going to ask for help with your first name. I'm going to try Xochi Valdez.
Xochi Valdez.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Xochi.
Yes. Xochi Valdez, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. We're looking forward
to it. My name is Xochi Valdez. Chair Dabney and members of the committee, my name is Xochi Valdez. Northfield Promise Storage Program has been another home for me. It's like the home I never had, and sometimes I feel like it's more welcoming than my own house. The staff feels like family, and I've talked to Torch staff about my problems that I've had when I haven't felt comfortable even talking to school or counselors or my parents. Mm-hmm. The middle school and high school Torch staff have been important role models to me. They do unnecessary things to make students feel better. They do more than their job and go above and beyond for us. They are really open to all types of cultures, and they help us express ourselves and our culture without being ashamed or embarrassed of anything. Being in Torch has given me awesome experiences that I never thought I'd be able to do. I got to do things like Tai Chi, going to camps I couldn't afford like Minojin and Camp Pepin, and they have helped me feel more comfortable being involved in school. Torch helped me pay for sports I couldn't afford, like wrestling, lacrosse, and volleyball. They also helped me register for driver's ed, gave me a scholarship and helped me pay for my permit test, which I passed in the first time last week. Being in Torch has helped me accomplish a lot with my academics, as well as during middle school, we had pizza parties for students who got the honor roll. I love pizza, so this motivated me to do well and get on the honor roll as much as I could. We also go to field trips like science museums, the zoo, and college visits. They also have college students that come and help in Torch. It was really awesome and fun to work with them. I ask questions about college life, and I feel more encouraged to go to college when I get older. Throughout middle school, I had depression, and I did not feel welcome or safe. most of the time. Torch was a really safe place where I felt supported, so I always try to go down during study hall or stay after school for Torch programs. The staff was really welcoming. They made me feel really comfortable talking about my mental health and family issues. At one point, I got so bad, I tried taking my own life. I felt more comfortable telling the people at Torch, especially since I didn't feel welcome at the counseling office. Torch staff knew me so well, they could see I was struggling and knew something was wrong. Today, I'm in a way better place, and Torch has helped me become that person. They are helping me become successful and see that there is more to life than just depression. I'm only in ninth grade, but I'm already planning to take PCO and AP classes in the next few years and go to college for a career for medical engineering. Please support House File 156 so Norfolk Promise Torch programs and the educational partnership of coalition members can continue to help students like me. Thank you so much for your time.
Ms. Valdez, thank you so much for sharing your story. It's powerful. We have a couple of questions. Representative Erickson, would you like to start us off?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be honored to start us off. You know, what's so amazing about the Northside Achievement Zone, the St. Paul Promise Neighborhood, the program in St. Cloud and throughout the state, is that their partnerships with community and their growing community. And so I think of them as full service communities, because you can tell from the testimony how powerful this has been during this pandemic, but it's powerful regardless. It was former Representative Loon who initiated the Northside Achievement Zone and the St. Paul Promise neighborhood. And it was former Representative Kelly, and these are both Republicans, keep in mind, who began the partnerships that we find in Red Wing, St. Cloud, et cetera. But the testimonies that have come from Ms. Daniels and Ms. Valdez are so compelling for us to realize the importance it is to be able to have a partnership within your community, to call on the community to help in times of need, but also to work on the goals that I know Ms. Samuels has initiated for the Northside Achievement Zone. They've done amazing work. And now to hear, you know, how they are extending their help with our students in learning, and the pods that Ms. Daniels talked about. So great that we had those for those children to take advantage of during their time away from the regular classroom. So, you know, my support is there for these kinds of full service communities. And I hope that when we see the February forecast, that we can proceed to provide more help for them. I haven't signed on to the bill yet, which I promised Ms. Clark I would do, but I need to see the February forecast before I commit myself to that. But I have great respect for this program. So, Mr. Chair, those are my comments about this proposal brought forth by Representative Wolkamott. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Erickson. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chair. Not a question, this is more of a comment to Sandra Samuels. I'm a fan. I'm a fan of your the work that you guys have done in the community. It's very effective work. I spent a lot of time talking about culturally competent, culturally intelligent organizations. A lot of times people make decisions for us that aren't for us because they don't know us. A lot of times decisions are made for us without us at the table. And so a lot of times we're on the menu as opposed to being, you know, and so I want to say personally, thank you so much, because I spend a lot of time, and it sounds like I'm only speaking for black men and women, when in all actuality, black children our focus, our investment. I heard someone ask how we find the money. Well, I believe that these budgets are a moral compass, and we can put whatever we want to in these budgets. Are these kids, our children, is that a good investment for each and everyone? Like, I want people to look in the mirror and ask yourself that. Are our kids a good enough investment to invest in? I think we should invest wisely, because the payoff will be greater later. I want to say thank you, Sister Samuels. If you can, give Brother Don a huge hug for me. I'm a fan. I listen to you on the radio, and I know the work that you do. I wish that work could come to St. Paul, North St. Paul, West St. Paul. Man, and I'm hoping that people see the importance of the work that you guys do in our community, and I hope that you continue to do the work, and God bless you and your family. Thank you so much.
Representative Jordan. Thank you, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Wolgema, for bringing this bill forward. I do want to thank NAS, especially for supplementing the 5 million meals that Minneapolis Public Schools distributed to families across the city, not just those enrolled in Minneapolis schools. So I know that those meals and that supplement of NAS really helps. Can you talk a little bit about the work you're doing to encourage mask use and why you think that's important?
Yes, thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Jordan. And yes, so we have some of the highest rates of infection. Black Minnesotans, I think it's a 10 times the rate. And just because of the risk factors. If you look at a heat map of the city of Minneapolis, North Minneapolis is on fire. And so we need our community to be safe. And so a lot of them went to schools and families and early childhood centers and really promoting the culture of being safe. And I'm glad that we are able to really lean into now so it's the mask wearing, but now for us, it's also the vaccine taking. And again, there's a lot of reasons why people in our community distrust the medical establishment. And there's a history with the African American community. And so we want to do what we can to mitigate that.
Representative Jordan.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I just wanted to give a shout out. Austin Aspires is right in my district, and one of the reasons why I wanted to sign into this bill is because of that. I just really appreciated Ms. Samuels talking about how we have built trust in our community for the last decade, and that's exactly what we need to be doing when we think about partnering with our schools. I know Austin Aspires. I have actually been on the board of Austin Aspires before I became a legislator and have worked with them as they created mentoring programs, as they have done other things in our community, as our community population has shifted quite a bit in the last 20 years. And it's been such a beautiful partnership with our schools and with Austin Aspires. And so thank you, members, for supporting the bill and for Representative Wolgema for authoring it. And it was a pleasure to be a co-author on the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mueller. Representative Wolgema, I think it's back to you, sir.
All right. Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank you, members, for taking the time to hear our presentation. And I really want to give a thanks to my testifiers who stepped forward and shared those courageous and powerful stories. You know, a lot of times at the legislature, we get lost in numbers on spreadsheets, and you coming in and having the courage to share your experience, to share, you know, what this partnership has meant to you and the difference that it's made in your life, I know really hits home for all of us. So thank you so much to my testifiers. And Mr. Chair, members, I ask that we do right by our students, that we do right by our families, and that we do right by our communities all throughout the state of Minnesota, and that we give full consideration and support for House File 156 in our committee's omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, and thank you, testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Wolgema. Let me also extend my appreciation to the testifiers. Thank you for taking the time and sharing your stories from around the state. Members, I think as before we close today, let me just observe that today, really, I think we had some opportunities to dig into some important bills and perspectives and maybe start the conversation the committee needs to have about, do we wait to see if we have the money to fund these programs, or do we see these programs as valuable and go out and find the money then to provide these programs in the state and these approaches? So that, I imagine, will be some of our discussion and deliberation as a committee for the next several months. I look forward to being a part of that. We will see you all back here tomorrow. Thank you all. We are adjourned.